Thank you for joining us for the Q&A session for our 2021 investor event. I'm joined by Brian Goldner, Deb Thomas, and several members of Hasbro senior management today. I will turn it over to the operator to facilitate the discussion. Lawrence?
Thank you. To ask a question over the phone line, please press star one. To withdraw your question, press the pound key. To accommodate all participants in the queue today, we ask that you ask one question and one follow-up. Please mute your computer speakers when asking a question to avoid echoes or feedback. Thank you. Your first question comes from the line of Fred Wightman. Your line is open.
Hey, guys. Good afternoon. Thanks for taking the question. In today's presentations, there was a lot of talk about increasing the mix of content spend on Hasbro brands versus partner brands going forward. Just wondering if you could put some specific numbers around that and how we should think about the mix over the next few years.
Yeah, Fred. As we look at Hasbro brands, we're just seeing an acceleration. You're seeing it for 2021. Obviously, you're also seeing acceleration of eOne revenues as well as Wizards revenues. Just as a percent of revenues, as we try to drive our partner brands revenues as high as they could possibly be, they likely come down by a little bit in terms of total percent of revenues this year, given the fact that we're expecting double-digit growth between the three business units, including getting eOne back to 2019 levels in TV and film. We do expect our family brand business within eOne to also grow, consumer products to grow, and then, of course, Magic: The Gathering. I think that percentage probably is still in the low 20% range in terms of revenues for our partner brands. We continue to invest in innovation, we continue to invest in marketing, and certainly are paying royalties. Just as we see the acceleration this year, and in a few years, over the next few years in Hasbro brands, that percentage probably comes down a little bit.
Sorry, I meant more so just on the content spend side of the equation as opposed to just sort of the revenue mix. If we're expecting to earmark more.
Oh, yeah.
Yep, more content dollars for Hasbro brands down the road. Where is that today? Where is it going to be next year, and where could that be three, four years down the road?
Oh, I see. You're not really talking about partner brands. You're talking about other third-party content. Now I understand.
Yep.
Yeah. Over time, and Steve and Olivier outlined for you, as did Darren, the fact that we're already up and underway with several Hasbro IP initiatives. That will attract the production capital dollars, whether that be the Dungeons & Dragons film or a Dungeons & Dragons live-action production, the Power Rangers production, Jon Entwistle collaboration. Over time, more and more of that production capital goes toward Hasbro brands. We want to continue to focus on other good third-party IP. eOne has done an excellent job of sourcing great material with great creative stewards. Deb, I don't know if you want to comment any further on that.
Hi, Fred. I think as we talked about moving the content forward to more Hasbro brands, that's when we'll see the increase in profitability. As Brian said, we see the opportunity to bring ourselves to an operating profit over the medium term to over 16%. As we gravitate more toward partner brands, that's when you're going to see that processing.
Great. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Steph Wissink from Jefferies. Your line is open.
Thank you. Hello, everyone. We have two follow-up questions. The first, Deb, is for you, just on the operating margin 2021. Can you just give us some insight into the base that you're referencing when you're looking back at 2020? I think there are a few different figures out there based on the adjustments. What is the base that you want us to use for operating margin for 2021? Brian, a bigger picture question for you. I think what we're hearing from you is based on this new segmentation, you would expect your business to deliver, you know, upper mid or even high single digit annual growth on the top line at expanding levels of margin. As we think about the cash flow, I think you mentioned $1 billion annually. How do you think about, you know, reinvesting that cash? I think one of your directors represented that maybe some of the investment in content could come off of your balance sheet or from your balance sheet instead of using some of these third-party financing vehicles. So maybe talk about the $1 billion cash flow level and how you would think about allocating that under this new business structure. Thank you.
Sure. Deb, you want to go first?
Sure. Well, thanks, Steph. When we talk about operating profit and our growth, we talk about our adjusted operating profit, which was 15.1% in 2020.
Great. And Steph, as you look at what we intend to spend in production capital over the next few years, we'd said we expect to be at the high end of that range that we had given of 675 to 750. Clearly, this year it's partly because we're catching up on some of the productions that we had planned for 2020. But as we look forward, we just see so much opportunity. And clearly, for every Hasbro IP we activate in entertainment and then take across the blueprint, Hasbro brands enjoy higher operating margins. It engenders that consumer products business that has higher operating profit margins as well. Our franchise brands enjoy higher operating margins, as does our games business, as does Wizards of the Coast. And clearly this year, we have a bit of a small step back on Wizards operating margin just because we are paying for the development of the digital games that are being launched this year. But we believe in the out years, Wizards again's operating margin can expand as it has, and we'll continue on that track to double in size. So as we look at ways of investing in our business, clearly we always are looking first and foremost how to invest in Hasbro. And we're going to look to activate Hasbro IP. We're also going to look to continue to develop an array of games for our Wizards brands. Right now we do use some production financing. We think that's good risk mitigation. And we'll take decisions about that over time. But between the risk mitigation strategy that Steve Bertram outlined for you, where only 30% of our production capital is really at risk at any period in time, given the way we either pre-sell or license, and the way that we use outside production funding, we think it's smart. It's a risk mitigated model. And clearly, we will consider how we change that mix over time. Deb, I don't know if you want to comment further.
Hi, yes, no, I think as we do look at that, that's where you see the expansion in the operating profit margin. And I would add, you also see the expansion in EBITDA. You know, as we look at that and we drive the growth in our various brands, we see the improvement in the EBITDA percentages and margins as well. And depreciation does have an impact on that in the shorter term.
And Deb, just to follow up on that, how should we think about cash flow conversion from that $1 billion level? Is your CapEx likely to stay pretty stable? Again, I recognize that there is some depreciation and tooling for Peppa and PJ and the acquisition.
Right. I think this year we've talked about $165 to $175 million in CapEx. You know, normally our CapEx level has been, last year it was about $120. It's usually in the $130 to $140 range. So I see while we're investing more in digital game development, it'll be a bit higher, but we'll be seeing the revenues that come with that as well.
Yeah, but I would expect it to be somewhat in this range at the
Yes, I wouldn't expect it to go higher than that range, the 165 to 175.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Eric Handler from MKM Partners. Your line is open.
Yes, thanks for taking my question. Wondered if you could maybe provide a little bit more depth in terms of how you're thinking about revenue growth over the next several years. First, you know, when you look at all of the new entertainment gaming content that's coming out, that should lead to, you know, improved toy production. So why wouldn't you be able to outpace the toy industry growth for several years to come? And I'm just curious, sort of, what do you view as a good growth rate to use for the toy business? Secondly, you know, when E1 was an independent company, I believe in some of their annual filings, they talked about being able to grow revenue at a double-digit rate. Is that is that a good number to think about in the coming years? And then what might you think about the gaming business growing over the next several years?
Sure. Well, we've said that we expect this year that we could be in line with or ahead of the industry for consumer products, and certainly our plans are continue to be somewhat ahead of the industry. And that has a lot to do with the innovation, the creativity, our content to commerce capability, our e-com and omni-channel capability. And Eric outlined that along with Kim and then Casey as he accelerates his consumer products business. That should all lead to higher growth rates. You're right. We do believe that E1 can compound double-digit growth. Clearly, our first priority is to get E1, and we believe they will achieve numbers that are very similar to 2019 revenues. So that would be a substantial step up in revenues growth for 2021, get back on track. They're actively producing and delivering, and you heard from the team the robust plans that now increasingly include the Hasbro IP that enjoys the high operating margin and the additional streams of income that get created as a result of activating content in that space. And then for Wizards, we're about, as Deb said, by 2020, we're more than halfway through our goal of doubling the size of Wizards of the Coast. We expect the CAGR for the Wizards business to continue at a robust pace to enable us to achieve the doubling in size of that business. But clearly, you heard from Chris and you saw the gaming plans. Our enthusiasm for that business is very high, very strong. The returns that we're seeing as we take Magic Arena and we take it to mobile, as we are seeing the early feedback on Dark Alliance from our own Toot Studios, and you'll hear more about the feedback that we're getting as we launch that game. And then future games, the fact that Chris has more than a dozen games in development, including new IP that really reflect this idea of a lifelong love of gaming and that ability to have a lifestyle game that you can literally enjoy for a lifetime. We think the fantasy gaming area is unique and differentiated. The way that Chris and the team approach that allow us to get higher revenues and, frankly, much higher margins. And that margin will return to where it's been more classically, like the last year. Over the next few years, clearly we have to pay for some of the early digital game development that we've been doing. So you're right. We expect Hasbro to grow at a faster pace than it has historically, and we believe we have the tools to accomplish that. In return, we also expect the operating margin, as Deb outlined, to get north of the 16%, which was our, it's like 15.7 was our highest operating margin, certainly in my tenure. And we'll get north of that in the next 2 to 3 years. The cash generation does go toward $1 billion or better over time. And we expect that higher rate of return across the business.
Great. And just one quick follow-up for Deb, a little bit of an accounting in the weeds question for you here. Video games in that business, GAAP accounting can be impossible to model because there are tons of revenue deferrals. Just wondering, with this business, is there a big difference between what would be the GAAP revenue and sort of how the rest of the industry in video games looks at revenue, more of like a cash bookings type basis, and does that create a lot of distortion in your revenue numbers?
given where we sit with the games that we have in the past, as you know, Chris mentioned our licensed gaming, our licensed game portfolio is pretty quick turnover. It's straight revenue as it's reported to us, but we have a pretty quick turnaround now. So I think, and that's in the time periods in our 10K. So I would look to that, Eric. I don't know that it's as long as some other companies may have from a differential standpoint.
Okay. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Arpine Kocharyan from UBS. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you for the Q&A session. You mentioned about 16% of operating profit margin medium term, and Hasbro has come close to that before on adjusted basis in the underlying toy and licensing business, but of course you're now integrating E1, which carries operating margins a bit lower. But then when we think about vertical integration of the toy business, which can be certainly margin accretive for you over time, and then Wizard business doubling, I'm trying to understand why 16% is the right number, if you could give us some broad sort of puts and takes.
Yeah, we just said north of 16%. We didn't say 16%. We're trying to give you a frame of reference that says we fully expect our business to be more successful from a profitability standpoint than it's ever been in our recent history as we go forward. So we expect in the next 2-3 years to be able to surpass 16% operating profit margins, and then we'll update you as we go forward. But certainly believe that the earnings power of this company, as we activate more Hasbro IP across more of the brand blueprint, we should be able to achieve those levels. And that's just the next mile marker as we think about the next 2-3 years. But it's certainly not a ceiling. It's just a floor.
That is very helpful. Thank you. And did I hear right that the consumer product segment will actually grow operating margin this year, not just profit dollars during the presentation? I think I heard margins, but I just wanted to clarify quickly.
That's correct. Consumer products will grow operating margin this year.
Thank you. And then just quickly, my follow-up. You know, during the presentation, there was a mention of targeting 4 to 5 points of higher market share with the $7 billion of preschool super category from something like 2.5% share today. By my math, that's about $350 million of revenue. I thought the opportunity should be sort of larger given the $700 million of toy business within E1, which is mostly in preschool. I guess I'm just trying to understand what percentage of the roughly $700 million of toy business wholesale will be vertically integrated into Hasbro by year, say, 2023.
Yeah, so we noted, and now I'll ask Deb to comment on the future plan, but we noted that this year we should get a contribution of $75 to $85 million in revenue. In the out years, it should be several hundred million dollars in revenue just for Peppa and PJ. And then Olivier outlined a few new properties that we're launching. I think Eric, as he opened up the presentation, talked about a minimum of $500 million opportunity in preschool. And we think that's the first minimum opportunity we have in that segment. Then we can look at growing from there. Deb, I don't know if you want to comment further on the future plans, the strategic plan.
Right. And, you know, as we look at it, our P&A, we see some of that consumer product revenue will move out of entertainment, where you may have seen it in the past, and move up toward in the consumer products as we start gaining that wholesale revenue. But don't forget, we don't really start introducing until the holiday season, late this year, and in 2022 we'll be ramping as well. So as you look to the future, we see great opportunity in preschool with the E1 brands that have been introduced today and the ones that are in the pipeline too. So we see lots of opportunity in the future.
This is all very helpful. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Mike Nang from Goldman Sachs. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you very much for the question. Just first on Wizards of the Coast, you know, there clearly is a lot of innovation across both tabletop and digital gaming. I was just wondering if you could just help outline some of those initiatives between those that may be more near-term, you know, benefiting, let's call it 2021, and those initiatives that might be a little farther out. And then I have a quick follow-up.
Sure. Let me comment just for a second, and then I'm going to ask Chris Cox to comment as well. But look, I think that Magic has moved up the number of releases and the cadence of releases, and the strength of releases are quite good. But I'll remind you, just as we may not have another opportunity to cover this, that, you know, last year in Q1, we were preparing for the pandemic. So as you think about the modeling for 2021, think about the bigger comp opportunities being in Q2 through the rest of the year, and in Q1 a little more just a little more challenging as a comp, but the brand continues to perform incredibly well. So you have the tabletop and tabletop innovation, you have digital tabletop as well, and then a range of games that Chris had outlined for this year, including the Dark Alliance game, Magic Arena going to mobile, Spell Slingers, as well as some third-party games. But let me turn it over to Chris and talk about a little bit of the future plans that he has, that he had outlined.
Yeah, sure. Hey, Mike. Nice to see you. Nice to hear you again. So for 2021, I think we have a pretty balanced plan between tabletop as well as digital. Brian, I think, outlined several of the initiatives that we talked in the presentation. You know, we continue to see robust growth in our tabletop business. We're looking forward to the resumption of organized play, which I think constitutes over 1 million events that we run through stores that we effectively put on hold this time last year. And we're hopeful that will come back in the second half of this year. So we see that as certainly a tailwind. You know, the first of our crossover products with D&D and Adventures in the Forgotten Realms, we think will be a nice kind of a marquee product in the middle of the year that will benefit both our tabletop business as well as Arena. And then we have, several digital launches between us and our partners. Baldur's Gate 3 released late last year. Larian just had just announced a major update to that just this past week. And they will continue to do updates on that early release product throughout 2021. Magic Arena went into early access on mobile for a small percentage of Android phones in late January. And by the end of Q1, we plan to release that for all mobile phones and tablets on Android and iOS. And we see that being a significant boost to the products, both for Magic and D&D. I'm sorry, Magic tabletop and digital. And then a series of new products will release later in the year. Dark Alliance from our Took Studio, which will be the first self-published game by Wizards of the Coast in the D&D line. Later in the year, Magic Spellslingers, which we think will introduce the brand to a broader segment of players, a more casual set of fans who can come into the Magic franchise. And then our partners at Cryptic later this year will be expanding their beta and hopefully going to a full commercial launch of their action role-playing RPG, Magic Legends. So 2021, I think, has a series of initiatives spread across quarters that will be buoyant to our overall growth plans. And then in the midterm, you know, we started talking about some of the other initiatives that we have. I think we see a fairly balanced growth pattern between tabletop and digital as those start to release. We're not prepared to talk about timelines on those yet, but our portfolio for digital releases spans from 2022 to 2027. And our tabletop plans will continue to be investing behind and continue to find new entertainment partners that we think will expand the opportunity for Magic, like we announced with Warhammer 40,000 and Lord of the Rings. Warhammer 40,000 should release in 2022. And then we'll announce timings on other entertainment partnerships and cross collaborations in future months and future quarters.
Great. Thanks for that very comprehensive answer, Chris and Brian. And just as a follow-up for Deb, it sounds like the high-level kind of financial guidance for 2021, you know, potentially double-digit revenue growth and flattish or flat EBIT margins is pretty consistent with what you guys said on the 4Q20 call. I was just wondering if any of the components varied at all from what was said on the 4Q20 call. You know, gross margins, I think this is the first time you've commented on, for instance. Thanks.
Mike, nothing has varied from what we said on the Q4 call. And, you know, I just remind you, while we talked about the components of gross margin, we do look at it with program amortization as well as our cost of sales.
Okay, thank you. So the gross margin similar to 2019 levels of, I think, 60%, that the headwind from program amortization?
Yes.
Okay, yep. Thank you.
And that's consistent with what we said at on our call.
Okay, sorry, I must have missed that. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of David Beckel from Berenberg Capital Markets. Your line is open.
Hey, thanks so much. I have two questions. First one, I guess a bit higher level, longer term. I was hoping you could help frame the return on investment opportunity of content that's self-produced, as in, you know, in conjunction with E1 rather than a third party. Do you think about it in terms of an ROI perspective, as in you put $100 million into a production and expect to get a net operating profit of X on the back end throughout the implementation of the blueprint? And if so, would you mind like characterizing, you know, what type of return as investors we could expect to see going forward? And then I have a follow-up. Thanks.
Sure. Well, you know, we clearly are looking at that return. I think Steve and Bertram and the team did a really nice job of showing you how we get a return on the content spend that we are creating. And then in addition, of course, we are generating incremental or new revenues around either an existing Hasbro IP or a vault or a new IP that is a Hasbro owned and operated IP at high operating margin in consumer products, both traditional toy and game, as well as licensed consumer products, as well as in the gaming. And so we have an internal measure for that on ROIC. And Deb, I don't know how much you might want to share there as we look at our modeling.
Certainly. When we look at some of those larger productions that we talk about featuring Hasbro IP, we obviously expect a greater return. I think Steve did a great job outlining when we're looking at scripted TV or film, how we defray some of the risk on that and what the types of returns are. Now, we get the benefit if it's Hasbro IP in the future, which is where we see the growth potential in our operating profit margin and EBITDA. We get the benefit of it working entirely around the blueprint. We've seen that in the past working with partners on films like Transformers. But if as we work forward with E1 and they're the producers and releasing any type of content in a different way, if it's Hasbro-related content, we have a greater return from that. And even if we look at some of, you know, the unscripted production, that's funded by the person who's ordering that production. So when you think about returns, we look at them differently for each item. And when you think about our brands, you know, our franchise and the brands that are key to the company remain the most important brands. We talked about a few today that are currently in the entertainment pipeline, and that's where you're going to see the greater return.
All right, thanks. That's helpful. And just as a follow-up, I think I heard correctly you expect e-commerce to represent 50% of your consumer product business in the near future. So clearly you're planning to either lean into that category or expect it to just naturally grow. I'm wondering, you did mention, I believe as well, that you don't necessarily expect a different margin per se on that channel, but I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about the return on advertising investment you've seen through that channel. Have you seen, especially this year with such great growth in that channel, a stronger return on investment such that an equal level investment relative to traditional media forms might actually generate a higher rate of sales growth over the long term?
Yeah, well, you've asked a question that they're kind of all those elements are really wrapped together. So what we said is that we do expect that our e-commerce business, including omnichannel, should be about 50% of our business by 2025. Recognize that as you look at e-com, we are agnostic about growth in e-com and are focused on the growth of e-com and omnichannel. The costs of executing an e-commerce omnichannel program fall into different buckets, but overall the cost of business is very similar to cost of business that we do in other channels, and that's why we can grow without worry about giving up any margin as a result. One of the things you're pointing out is that advertising, which it historically would sit in an advertising line, when you look at e-commerce or omnichannel execution, those advertising costs can sit up in the cost of sales because of the way we're using SEO and other algorithmic marketing, content to commerce marketing, or other short form content that we use to drive the algorithm, to drive the returns on the search, or to ensure that the consumer is getting to see the best overall presentation of our product linked to our brands and our brand's message. So I'd say, yes, we can get a very strong return on our digital marketing initiatives. Overall, digital marketing for the company is about a third of our total spend. And we do get a higher rate of return. And that's been true for a while. And that's why overall you have seen the percent that we spend in traditional advertising has drifted downward over time from our historical roughly 10% of our advertising to sales downward, but yet the effectiveness has increased.
Very helpful. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Sean Collins from Citi. Your line is open.
Great. Hi, Brian, Deb, and team. Nice to speak with you. Good afternoon. Hey, my question is thanks, Brian. My question is on e-commerce. It represented about 30% of your global retail sales, up from 20%, you know, big growth. I'm just wondering, what does this mean for Hasbro in terms of any change in overall margins or if that's really at the retail level? And then also, any need for you to change your warehousing and distribution strategy as a result? Any color might be helpful. Thanks.
Yeah, you know, we've continued to evolve our distribution strategy domestically. We've continued to open new warehouses and added new capabilities and technologies inside of the warehouses, including flex warehouse space, where we literally can move our inventory to be e-com or an omnichannel retailer's inventory within moments. It enables us to get that just-in-time delivery of inventories. We have seen a change in the way we do our trucking, and Deb has talked about a few of the short-term cost pressures associated with that because, of course, if we're going out to e-com, we may be using LTL trucking or less-than-truckload shipments, but we're also accommodating for that in the way we are executing our programs. But, yeah, so overall, the puts and the takes say that we can execute e-com at the same cost of business or operating margin is the rest of our business. It's incentivizing us to continue to drive that business. We're able to give the consumer a virtual, immersive, full experience of our brands because of our capabilities. You saw them really on display today from every member of the team. If you're able to create that kind of immersive experience in a digital format, you can just imagine what a consumer feels when they look at our Nerf product lineup or our Play-Doh product lineup or Transformers product lineup and how excited they can get, even though they haven't physically handled the product. They have a pretty good idea of how satisfied they'll be when they purchase it.
Great. Thank you for the insight. I appreciate that.
Your next question comes from the line of Gary Johnson from BMO Capital Markets. Your line is open.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I promised to limit myself to one question, but it is multi-parts. I'm curious about, I think RPNA mentioned the family brands. The insourcing of PJ and Peppa, can you give us still a little bit more about the cadence? What segments are coming in-house this year? What segments will come in later years? And then also the $75 to $85 million impact. Is that a net number, you know, taking out the royalty revenue you were getting before, call it about $15 million maybe, and then adding the wholesale revenue you're getting in, maybe about $100 million? Is that a net number or is that a gross number? Thank you.
Sure. So a couple things. I'd like to ask if Eric Nyman, if you could talk a little bit about the TJ and Peppa product lines, the number of SKUs that we're developing and how we're executing that and how we see that going forward. So over to you, Eric.
Sure. Thanks, Gary. Thanks, Brian. So for 2021, as Deb mentioned, the PJ and Peppa efforts will really begin this fall and into holiday. We're working extremely efficiently as a team to bring about 50-plus SKUs for PJ Masks and another 50-plus SKUs incrementally for Peppa Pig across, you know, a range of categories. As we go into 2022 and some of the license agreements that E1 had in place, we'll continue to migrate more and more of that business over. And we have, you know, as Brian and Deb already covered, some real optimism for what we can do with that business over the next 2 to 3 years.
Okay, and Deb, on numbers?
Yeah, let me just add, and that was a number that was net of the licensing that will go away in that period. However, it's, and I think you summarized it well, you know, it's the margin impact that's net, right? So that will be net of the licensing impact. But on the revenue side, yes, you know, we tried to make it net so you could just model it against the revenue that's in there now.
Yeah, okay. And hey, maybe I can squeak another one in there. On Wizards of the Coast, that category, will the tabletop be included in consumer products or in Wizards of the Coast?
No, tabletop is in Wizards of the Coast. So all Wizards is in Wizards of the Coast.
Okay, all right, great, thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Linda Bolton Weiser from D.A. Davidson. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you. So in listening to your presentations, I mean, one thing that hit me is that there's just so much, you know, there's so much content. And as you said, there's 1,500 brands, and you're going to be developing content for many of those. I wonder if from an allocation of capital perspective, it might not make sense to kind of retain that franchise brand concept, which seems to have gone away, both for the content development and then how it interrelates with the toy business. So can you just talk about, like, have you thrown aside that franchise brand concept, or is that something that is going to kind of evolve, or are you just going to make movies and TV for 1,500 brands? Thanks.
Sure. Well, no, you're absolutely right. And clearly today we tried to outline for you, if you were to go down the list of our most important and listed franchise brands, you would see the vast majority of those are getting E1's attention and content creation at first. So you're seeing clearly between Transformers and My Little Pony, lots of work and effort there. You're seeing for Magic the Gathering, we talked about some of the work there. And then you have some of our most formidable brands with the greatest opportunity that rest within an owned and operated power brand portfolio, We may not have identified them today as franchise brands, but clearly as owned and operated brands, they have immense opportunity. And that includes an array of brands like Power Rangers and Dungeons and Dragons. And so we intend to continue to have a franchise brand formula and a franchise brand structure. We have other power brands within the owned and operated Hasbro brands that we're activating, and we've gotten great creative stewardship on those brands, and so we include those as well. And then over time, clearly, every company would expect to evolve, and the dynamic changes we're seeing in the marketplace and the opportunity to create more branded content. I'm going to ask Darren to comment in a moment about just the marketplace, because he's out talking to this array of buyers for content and working with these creative stewards. And, you know, clearly we're going to abide by the principles of our most important brands being executed most fully and first. But we also have this range of incredible brands that are in the vault that are just waiting for creative stewardship and the E1 team's activation. So, Darren, maybe you could comment for a moment about what the team is focused on. We need some sound. Maybe you're on, are you on mute?
No, I should have sound. Can you hear me now?
Oh, there you go. We can hear you now.
Oh, you can hear me now? Okay, good. Fair to say, since we've come together, our primary, we sat down and we prioritized the brands that the team would spend the most time on. And those included things like Power Rangers, Dungeons and Dragons, Magic, My Little Pony, et cetera, G.I. Joe, et cetera. But they also included some vault brands that we think have tremendous opportunity if we can lock entertainment and, you know, get that in front of the consumer and get engagement from the consumer, that we can then power that entire franchise that we have here at Hasbro. So brands like Action Man and Micronauts. So there are so many, but it's fair to say that from an entertainment standpoint, we sat down both on the family brand side and on the film and TV side and prioritized the brands that we collectively thought had the biggest opportunity to give the best economics to all of our stakeholders.
Thank you. Can I ask? Yes, thank you. Can I ask another question? Again, in listening to the whole presentation, and most of us here are toy analysts, and we're not media and entertainment analysts, so I don't think I've ever heard a whole presentation by Disney, but it strikes me that your presentation and your company is a lot like Disney. So I wonder, if that's not true, can you distinguish in what way you are different than a Disney? And also, would Disney become a little more reluctant to license out some of its brands to you for consumer products as your profit mix changes over time to become even more kind of digital and media and entertainment? Thanks.
Sure. Well, you know, in partnership with the Walt Disney Company for many years, I've been very privileged to be able to work with that team, as have so many people in our company. And we really do treat their brands like our brands. And our expertise of owning brands and owning IP and knowing what it means to be a brand owner and how important it is that our innovation come to life in our products that reflect the real meaning of the story and the character that the Disney creatives are making and creating and delivering on so many engaging platforms really speaks to the strength of the relationship. You know, we are constantly bringing new innovations to Disney brands, first and foremost, to those brands. These aren't second-generation innovations, they're first-generation. And you can see that in the results that we've been able to create around brands like The Mandalorian. You know, we didn't create just a handful of the child products. We created dozens of products. We created Black Series products, a new role-play products, a whole new vehicle lineup that kids are really embracing, a whole new role play lineup. And so that's how we really look at our relationship, whether it's Marvel, whether it's Disney Princess and Frozen, or whether it's Star Wars. We're looking at bringing the best creativity and the most innovation to those brands. And we are different than Disney in that, you know, Disney now is obviously, we don't have theme parks. We are licensing out. We heard about Peppa Pig. That's a licensed arrangement with the location-based entertainment team that we do have embedded here at the company, but those are third-party licenses. Transformers is at a theme park at Universal, but again, managed by somebody else with our creative partnership and stewardship. You know, many of our brands began as playthings, but are migrating across a spectrum of engagement. Now, with E1, many of our brands can begin as story and character, as the family brands team with Olivier or Steve Bertram can begin to tell stories around our brands and tap into the vast canon or mythology for a brand like Dungeons & Dragons or Magic the Gathering. But, you know, we in every way support the Disney relationship, and we believe that Hasbro, given the fact that we are an independent brand owner and a content creator, can present great content and story to any number of platforms. But remember what Olivier said earlier on: PJ Masks is appearing on Disney Plus and on Disney Junior. The new property that he outlined is appearing on Disney Plus and on the Disney television, linear and terrestrial television networks around the world, in addition to other network supporters and broadcast providers. But in every way, we look at building our business both independently and with the Walt Disney Company.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Brian Callen. Your line is open.
Thank you. Deb, with regard to the delay in deleveraging and the $1 billion pay down path, it seems that it gives you very little headroom to remain IG relative to the rating agency requirements. So can you just speak to that commitment and more specifically how you might upsize the $1 billion if you needed to, or you know what you can do to respond to pressure on the ratings front?
Sure, Brian, and good afternoon to you. We said that we have about $1 billion that comes due by January of 2023, and that includes a $300 million of debt that we have due in May. That was Hasbro long-term debt, as well as we have about $600 million due late in 2022, and then about another $100 million of term loan amortization. As you might have seen at the end of 2020, we actually paid $100 million of our term loan down early. So as we look at our commitment, we remain fully committed to get back to that 2 to 2.5 times. And we said last year may have impacted the time frame to bring us to 3 to 4 years, but we continue to assess our liquidity and our availability of cash and the ability to pay off the term loans that we have outstanding early, as we did partially at the end of 2020. In addition to that, we continuously meet with the rating agencies and share with them what our plans are. We said we would achieve our targets through growth in EBITDA as well as paying down debt. But we continuously are looking at our ratios and how to get back to those in the most effective manner.
Thank you.
And your next question comes from the line of Tammy Zakaria from JP Morgan. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. So I have a very short-term focused question, which is, as you think about E1 revenues this year going back to 2019 level, can you comment on the cadence of how that's going to be realized? Is it going to be more uniform throughout the four quarters or maybe front half or back half weighted?
Yeah, I think it's a great question, and thank you for asking it. It will be more back half weighted. And just give you an example. In 2019 and 2020, we were still receiving revenues for theatrical releases. And in fact, had a very strong theatrical release during that time called 1917, a great movie that we were receiving great revenues for. Clearly, this past year, with theatrical being closed down, you don't get those same revenues in the first quarter. So what I would encourage you to look at is more of a back half weighted revenues cadence for E1, but recognize that overall we expect those strong growth rates. We have the shows in development as well as the sales and the productions underway, but Q1 will be lighter than subsequent quarters.
Got it. That's super helpful. And if I may ask a more longer-term oriented question, I think you mentioned, call it about one-third of your sales were coming from e-commerce, omnichannel in 2020. So I'm guessing that's mostly third-party website-generated revenues. So can you give us a sense of what your own DTC, direct-to-customer revenues are currently? And we've been hearing from other consumer companies like Nike or Estee Lauder that they're trying to go increasingly direct-to-customer by having their own website-generated sales. So what's your plan around that? Is that in the cards, and how does the margin differ in that case if it's generated on your own website versus someone else's?
Yeah, so you're right. The bulk of the revenues today that we are generating in e-com and omnichannel co with our third-party partners and global retailers. As Eric noted in his presentation, the Pulse has been very successful. And he said, and we do expect, that the revenues there should double each and every year going forward. But it's off of a relatively small base. You know, we first had to find a lighthouse identity for the Pulse. We had to ensure that we could find a way to engage the fan and the fan economy in a manner that was unique and differentiated. While we still gave great exclusivity and new products in this fan area, fan community and fan area to our retailers as well. And so in doing so and in creating that, we've been able to carve out a great content and commerce engine in the Pulse. You hear, of course, we're going to launch this in new countries this year and then subsequent new countries going into 2022. So we see a great long-term opportunity. I think the frame of reference of a Nike or others for the sneakerheads is a good one. We want to continue to enthrall and delight our fans with great, unique content, great opportunities for product, but also offer unique and differentiated products for our retailers. There are just some really high-end opportunities. We talked about kickstarting HeroQuest game. We talked about the Razor Crest, which is, of course, the Mandalorian ship that we were that we kicked off on a Pulse Kickstarter campaign. We've had our own products, the first one of which, if you remember, was Jabba the Hutt sail barge a year or two ago. So we'll continue to have those high-end products from both Hasbro IP as well as our partners' IP, and we see a unique opportunity with the Pulse. That's different than the immense opportunity that we see with our other retail partners.
Great. Thank you so much. And thanks for hosting this great event.
No more phone questions. Debbie, back to you.
No sound.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Sorry about that. So I just was saying thanks to everybody for all their work on the event, and thank you for everyone for joining us today. As we've showcased how we're supercharging our brand blueprint to drive value for our stakeholders. Thank you.
This concludes our conference for today. Thank you all for participating. You may now disconnect.